Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We certainly have a full house this morning. I know we're going to see some students from Ripon College later in the day, but are any of them here this morning? Nope, it's just another group. Okay, well, we welcome you. Welcome you, one and all. You'll notice that on my right-hand side, Justice Abrahamson's seat is empty. She is with us. She is on the phone as we speak. So if you hear a voice coming from the clouds, it's Justice Abrahamson wanting to ask a question. So there
clouds
may be,
or somewhere.
Yes, right. So in any case, just so you are aware of that. With that brief announcement, then, we will begin with our first case, Porter versus the State of Wisconsin. Are you prepared to begin? Please do.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. This is not a case about resurrecting lawfare, at least as it is often understood, and certainly as it is described by the state here. Lochner stands for the proposition the court should engage in plenary review of what the legislature has done and decide whether it made the right choice. That is not what the plaintiffs seek here. We only ask that we be given a chance to show that in light of the evidence, there is no real and substantial relationship between the anti-combination law and its positive ends.
Counselor, why should we use the standard of real and substantial relationship? Why not use rational basis? That's generally how we review legislation that does not involve a protected class or a fundamental right.
I think that as we see the real and substantial relationship test, it is not inconsistent with rational basis review. In other words,
why do you want to change it then? What is the difference? If it's the same, why not just keep the words the same? We know what they mean.
Because I think this is a case which has called upon us to take a close look at what rational basis review means. In our view, what it means, at least in cases that involve the right to earn a living or to engage in an otherwise lawful business, it means something like insisting on a real and substantial relationship. It means, and this is the word I would prefer, insisting on actual rationality.
So why isn't the preservation of competition real and substantial?
The preservation of competition would be a real and substantial interest. The question here and the issue below was not whether that is a legitimate state purpose. And one of the things that we're not asking courts to do in cases like this is to decide which ends the legislature is permitted to pursue or not to pursue. I mean, there would be some things, obviously, that would be illegitimate. But what we are focused on here and what the issue below was is accepting the hypothesized ends for the anti-combination law. And given the record and the evidence and what we know of the world and this industry, is it rational to conclude that the anti-combination laws might serve those ends? And while rational speculation would be appropriate until we have a record, once we do have a record, the question that comes before the court is whether or not there is a real and substantial relationship between the anti-combination law and the goals that it is hypothesized to serve, or is that relationship non-existent or so attenuated?
So you're saying until we have a record, what exactly is the relief you're asking us for?
Well, what the relief that we're asking for here is to reverse the circuit court's grant of summary judgment and remand the matter back so that we have an opportunity to show, and we're willing to accept that the burden of proof is on us, We're willing to accept that that burden is relatively high.
Are you asking for a factual determination at the circuit court?
We are asking for a factual
determination. So every time there's a law now that somebody doesn't like, we let the circuit court find facts on it when the legislature has had hearings throughout the state before they made a decision. Is that where you want us to go?
At least when it comes, given this court's prior decisions, right, in which we have laid them out in our brief, and the court consistently has looked at the evidence. At least when it comes to the right to earn a living and to engage in an otherwise legitimate business. And so we believe in cases such as this, it would be irrational for anyone to pursue an end when the facts show that it is extremely, it is either impossible, literally, or extremely unlikely that that end will ever be achieved by the means that have been chosen.
Then we are supposed to tell the legislature that the policy they set after their hearing is what? Doesn't have a factual basis, so therefore you're saying there's no rational relationship for it, so it's unconstitutional. I'm not quite following where you're going.
I think in a case like this, the question before the court would not be a plenary or wholesale review of the choice that the legislature has made. It would be to ask one simple and rather narrow question, and that is, given what we know of the world, is it rational to think that the anti-combination law would serve the hypothesized ends? In other words, to quote Justice Willett, now Judge Willett, from the Texas Supreme Court, now on the Fifth Circuit, we cannot take the rationality out of the rational basis test. We must insist on actual rationality.
But does it have to be? What's bothering me is, I mean, if you are arguing a question of law to me, I would understand it better. But if you want us to send this back for a factual determination that the law doesn't have facts underneath it such that they have propounded it did when they passed the law, because I don't know what all they heard. I mean, they were all over the state having hearings. We have never done that. That would be quite extraordinary.
No, the question here is not to assess the legislative process. I agree that that would not be something we would want courts to get into. In fact, the record here is that the funeral home directors drafted a law, they gave it to the legislature, and the legislature passed it. We are now in the realm of hypothetical justifications for the law, and the state has offered many of them in this case. They've abandoned most of them, and now they're down to two. And so the question before this court, and it would be the same under any real form of rational basis review. The test before this court is it rational to think that those hypothesized ends will serve the posited means? And the reason that we have to ask that question, the reason that we can't simply let anything go, is Article 1, Section 1. Article 1, Section 1 guarantees liberty to our citizens. And it is too late in the day to say that that language, that textual language, is merely exhortatory or aspirational or descriptive, because it has frequently been relied on this court to create real substantive rights. And I would suggest that this court has done that before. It did it in Jelke. It did it in Dairy Queen, where the judge noted in the course of his decision that he had tasted the product. It did it in Grand Bazaar. In all of these cases, the court looked at the record, and it said not that we have engaged in plenary review of what the legislature has done and we disagree with it, but that based upon this record, it is simply irrational to conclude that this law will serve the legitimate public purposes that has been hypothesized for. And under those circumstances, I think the courts have an obligation to act, because the power of the legislature over its citizens is not plenary.
So, counsel,
we have limited government.
In Jelke, the ban on oleo margin was struck down because, as a factual matter, oleo margin was not an unwholesome product, correct?
Yes.
And in Dairy Queen, the ban on Dairy Queen's product, whatever that might be, was struck down because it was not an unwholesome product, right?
Yes, and also because it was considered, in both cases, it was considered improper for the legislature to act basically to engage in economic protectionism and act only to protect one set of competitors over another, which
right.
we think is what's going on.
Yeah, so that was the, if it wasn't an unwholesome product, that was the only remaining possible rationale for the law, right, is that it was seeking economic protectionism.
Well, I think there was also an argument that this was necessary to protect dairy, to protect the dairy industry, mm-hmm. to protect dairy standards, and to protect the consumers from being fooled.
Okay, so there was a limited factual inquiry in those circumstances, yes?
Yes.
All right. But the it seems to me that perhaps, as I was reading through your brief, the way I understood this was the court has to make an inquiry into whether the law is capable of achieving the stated objectives, as opposed to inquiring into whether it actually did. Is that a legitimate distinction to be made?
Not sure that I follow the distinction that you are drawing. The way that I would put it is what the inquiry below has to be, given the facts, is there a relationship, a real substantial relationship is the term we would use. I don't want to get hung up on terminology, but that's the term that this court has frequently used in the past, in which we would suggest is probably the best term to use now. But is there a real and substantial relationship between the law and the hypothesized ends? Because we are dealing with hypothesized ends here. And I believe that means asking whether or not the plaintiffs have met the quite heavy burden of showing that there is no relationship between the law and the posited ends, or it is so attenuated that no rational person would choose that law to pursue those ends. That's a quite limited inquiry. And I don't believe that it will open the floodgate for litigation, because it would be very difficult for a plaintiff ever to win such a case. We think that this is an extraordinary record, where the facts show that the anti-combination law simply can't accomplish what it's supposed to accomplish, given the nature of this industry and the facts as we know them.
All right. Why would you not want to frame your argument in those terms? The anti-combination law, according to your brief, is not capable of achieving the objective it set out for itself, right? Because if you can show that it's not capable of achieving that objective, that's the end of the inquiry, right?
I would agree with you with the emendation that what has to happen is we determine whether it is capable in light of the others and what we know about the world as it applies to the application of this particular law.
Well, yes, but here's where I think the Chief Justice's concerns lie. If we have recourse to the facts on the ground to determine whether a statute is unconstitutional or not, the constitutionality of a statute could be in constant flux depending on what's happening in the world.
It's not. I would say a couple of things in response to that. First of all, that is not unprecedented, and the court has acknowledged from time to time, I think throughout its history, that is the case, right? We cited the Clark Oil Refinery cases and a number of other cases in which this court has said rational speculation is fine in and of itself, but when someone comes forward and they put forth evidence that suggests that rational speculation is not rational, then we have to take that into account. What's not unusual for the constitutionality of a law to turn on the adjudication of the facts. I've been involved in a number of constitutional cases throughout my career and a number of evidentiary hearings related to them. We have evidentiary hearings to determine intent. We have evidentiary hearings to determine impact. I mean, we have a major case involving this state, which is now pending before the United States Supreme Court, in which the constitutionality of legislative districts turns on the determination of the impact, at least in part, on the impact of those legislative districts on the respective prospects of the party. And, you know, any as-applied challenge is typically going to involve some type of consideration of the facts. And so it seems to me that the problem in
an as-applied challenge, though, you're asking for a declaration that the statute or regulation is unconstitutional as applied to that person, right? But here we are saying, I think, is your position, is that it is facially unconstitutional. And if it's facially unconstitutional, that can't vary from year to year, could it?
I don't think that the Act can vary. I don't know that the constitutionality of the Act can vary from year to year. We're not claiming that the anti-combination law was constitutional in 1938 and is not constitutional in 2018. We believe it was never unconstitutional. But we believe that to protect the liberty guaranteed by Article 1, Section 1, it's necessary to do more than simply look at the law and say, well, it doesn't violate the principles of formal logic, and it doesn't violate the laws of physics, and therefore we will uphold it. Because we think if you look at what this court has done in Grand Bazaar, it certainly was possible in Grand Bazaar that allowing liquor to be sold in grocery stores would have a number of salutary effects with respect to the enforcement of the alcohol laws, and in fact, even protecting small business and promoting competition. In fact, could have been hypothesized that in Grand Bazaar, the very foreclosure rationale, which is offered by the Supreme Court, could have, or the state here, could have upheld the law. The court said no. In light of the record, there's nothing in the record to support that. In light of what the plaintiffs have shown, the law is unconstitutional. And I think Article 1, Section 1 requires that. The state itself says in this case that economic protectionism for protectionism's sake would be unconstitutional and would require the type of examination that we call for here. Well, that is not a priori category of cases that we can determine at the time that the complaint is filed. The only way that we can know that the legislature has engaged in economic protectionism for protectionism's sake is by looking at the record and seeing whether or not there's anything that could conceivably cause a rational person to choose this law. And if the answer to that question, and in most cases, the answer to the question will be yes, there is, because I don't think the legislature
has. How do you differentiate this vertical integration, which is what your client's trying to do, with other vertical integrations that are prohibited under state and federal antitrust law?
Vertical integration is not prohibited under state and federal.
I understand it's not. Sometimes we permit it and sometimes we don't. In this case, the state didn't permit it.
The antitrust law does not prohibit vertical integration per se. And I think that the state's brief in this case overstates Brown Shoe. In fact, Brown Shoe and the antitrust laws have emphasized that you have to look at vertical integration in the context of a particular industry, because it is the fact that vertical integration is for the most part pro-competitive. It offers consumers something they want. So the question before the court here is, there's something about vertical integration, which we typically permit, in this particular case involving funeral homes and cemeteries that would justify prohibition. And we believe that we adduced enough evidence that would permit a court to conclude, no, there is not. There is not sufficient reason to believe that vertical integration here poses a problem either of foreclosure or abuse of trusting requirements. And under those circumstances, the law at that point becomes economic protectionism for protectionism's sake.
Well, whose economics is it protecting? You have a client that wants to exercise vertical integration. He still can earn a living doing what he's been doing, apparently, and now wants to expand to do something else that under the current law is prohibited.
In all of these courts' cases, in the Grand Bazaar case, it was certainly possible for somebody to have a grocery store without having a liquor department. In the Dairy Queen case, it was possible for somebody to have an ice cream shop and not sell an ice cream substitute. It was possible for somebody to sell something other than oleomargarine. The question
is, you're talking about in all of those cases, counsel, of an entity that's ongoing, that within that entity is doing something, okay? That's very different from what you're arguing today. You're arguing that a current entity, a current owner of that entity, can operate another entity, maybe separately, maybe together, but have combined ownership, and that's what's prohibited. So you're talking about two different entities in this case that you want to combine. The cases you refer to talk about a single entity with an item going on within that entity that is objected to, the selling of liquor or the selling of Dairy Queen rather than regular ice cream.
I think in a Dairy Queen case, what the complainants in that case were prohibited doing is opening a store that would sell Dairy Queen. But I don't think that that's the distinction, because I think what's protected here is the liberty of citizens, and the question here is, does the state have a sufficient reason to restrict Mr. Porter's liberty? But here's Mr. Porter's problem. Mr. Porter runs a business that competes with funeral homes, and funeral homes, by law, have a legal advantage, right? They are the ones that are most likely to be, by operation of law, the first point of contact when there's a death in the family. And he wants an opportunity to compete with them. He owns a cemetery, and the question is, what is the justification for the state to tell him that he can't engage in that business? And so I think the case here does pose the question of an infringement on his liberty to, as we phrase it, pursue his right to earn a living, pursue an otherwise lawful business. But the point here is not so much the formulation that we use, but the question is, we have a state imposition on a liberty that the state even concedes retains some importance and is important, and where the state concedes that we cannot have economic protectionism for protectionism's sake. And the only way I think that we can tell in any given case whether we have economic protectionism for protectionism's sake is to look at the situation before us.
But, counsel, aren't we examining the state's exercise of its police power? Isn't that what's going on underlying this law? They've made that determination that this is in the best interest of the citizens. That was the legislative determination, which is done, I believe, under their police power. It's a pretty broad power that the legislature has.
The police power is broad, but it is not unlimited.
But that's what we are dealing with, correct?
I can see that that's what we're limited to, because if you look at this court's cases, and there's a long line of cases that have protected the liberty that we seek to advance here, and I think as a historical matter, the court initially sort of saw these things as recognizing limitations on the state's police power, and has now come to phrase it in terms of substantive due process and equal protection, but I think the inquiry is the same. And it's a recognition that this police power is not plenary. And if the state is to restrict liberty through its exercise of the police power, there has to be a rational basis to do so. And the only thing that we are calling for here is actual rationality as determined by the facts on the ground. Plaintiffs are not often going to be able to win those cases. That's going to be a heavy burden. I liken it in some ways to this court's refusal to follow Employment Division versus Smith in religious liberty cases. That has not led to a flood of litigation because it's difficult to win these cases. And the standard that we advocate for here is a standard that I think remains quite deferential to the state, quite difficult for plaintiffs to overcome. We think in this case, we showed enough below, we should have an opportunity to prove that the anti-combination law simply has no real and substantial relationship to, no rational relationship to, the hypothesized ends in this particular case.
Since you have a moment or two,
it's a rare occurrence. I believe this is the first time that's ever happened to me.
So I hear your argument really as embracing the Jelke case and the template of analysis set forth in Jelke, which was equal protection case, which also was under the state constitution. And I hear your argument to be essentially eschewing or getting around, is this rational basis or is this rational basis with teeth? I'm looking at what the courts have done in the cases. Am I following what you're doing?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, so I guess in a nutshell it would be you think that the rationale offered for the exercise of police power has to be rational.
Right, right. With Justice Willett, we are insisting on actual rationality. We accept the heavy burden that is upon us. We accept the fact that we can't simply say that this was a poor choice, that we have to show that this was, in effect, an irrational choice. And we understand that that's difficult, but we believe that we introduced enough evidence below that we ought to be given an opportunity to make that case before the lower court. And that is all we're asking for here is, I think, quite limited request, and certainly not a return to Lochner or a request that this court substitute its own judgment for that of the legislature, which we do not call for that. And of course, I steadfastly oppose that.
In the few seconds you have remaining, what is your best distinction between your description of the rational basis test and Lochner?
The best description is the real and substantial relationship test in Lochner was employed by Justice Harlan I, and he dissented in Lochner. So this is not, we don't, and my red light is on.
You may answer that question.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We're not asking this court to conclude that there is some right that trumps whatever the legislature wants to do. We're not asking this court to weigh competing interests. We're asking this court to do a very, very narrow thing, and that is to say that there has to be a real and substantial relationship between means and ends, because it would not be rational if there was not.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Ryan Walsh, Chief Deputy Solicitor General, on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. I'd like to begin with the implications of Porter's constitutional theory and then turn to the reasons for this law. As I think has become clear, this case is only on its face about the anti-combination laws. Beneath the surface, this is an attempt to get this Court to throw off the fetters of judicial restraint and engage in what many proponents call judicial engagement. Now, if the court accepts Porter's invitation, the effects on the courts, on the legislature, and most importantly on the people will be sweeping. Consider that this is a facial challenge to a duly enacted state statute. If all it takes to get before a jury in a case like this, and our understanding is that they would like to get before a jury, if not a jury, then a bench trial. If all it takes is to hire an economist to sign an affidavit saying that a law does not make good economic sense, then we would submit that very few laws in the Wisconsin statute books would stand.
But isn't there a difference between that and an affidavit that says, given the realities of economics, this statute cannot accomplish the stated ends?
That would be different, Your Honor, but Porter's expert notably did not sign an affidavit that said that. He said he couldn't rule out that there, under certain circumstances, could be anti-competitive behavior in these markets. And most strikingly, what he said was that consumers actually pay more at combination firms in other states than they do at independent funeral directories. That's striking. Not 10% more, not 20% more, but 41% more, which is entirely consistent with the state's prediction that what happens in this market, given the conditions on the ground, given barriers to entry, and given, most importantly, the fact that this is not a perfectly rational market, combination firms face incentives to raise prices under certain circumstances.
Well, let's stop there for a second. Should we look at whether those circumstances pertain?
I think this court got it right in Madison Teachers, And in the Milwaukee Brewers case, this court said that intent is irrelevant. We look to rationality. And as Justice Thomas put it for the court in Beach Communications, rational speculation is enough. The Constitution doesn't require the legislature to spell out its purposes or to make findings of fact.
Yeah, let's put that to one side. I agree with you. But isn't it necessary for us to uphold the statute under rational basis review to figure out some way that there is a logical chain that connects the policy to the stated objectives?
Yes.
Okay. So in this case, your concern is the potential foreclosure effect of vertical integration, right?
Right, in part.
Okay. So as we look at that, doesn't it require for there to be the potential of foreclosure that there be a monopoly or near monopoly on some aspect of the vertically integrated firm?
No, because under antitrust law, not only is there a policy interest in preventing actual anti-competitive behavior, but there's also a prophylactic policy interest in even preventing the circumstances forming that could give rise to anti-competitive behavior.
Right. So don't we need, if we agree with you on this, don't we need to figure out whether the prohibition against combination under these circumstances could have that effect that you believe that it does?
If it passes the rational speculation test, then what this court has said is that the facts presumed to exist that would justify the rational speculation are continuously presumed to exist until the plaintiffs prove that they are false.
Yeah, but it's got to be something more than fantasy, right?
Something more than
fantasy?
That's correct. I mean, what, rational speculation as opposed to irrational speculation.
Yeah. So as I read your argument on the potential foreclosing effect of vertical integration in this industry, I couldn't make the logical connection work. And here's why. So if you have a cemetery that acquires a funeral home, and under your proposed operational effects, the cemetery would then raise prices to those customers who did not come through the captive funeral home, and it would lower prices for customers who did, right?
Yeah, that's one possible.
Okay. And that would have an anti-competitive behavior because you believe that would lead to the potential of adversely affecting the public. However, without having any potential monopolistic power in any part of the vertically integrated firm, I don't see how that works. Because the response to that by a consumer who faces that prospect and other cemeteries is that they would go to the other cemeteries, right? If the consumer decides I don't want to go to that funeral home, then he's got an incentive to go to a different cemetery because it would cost less.
The problem is that under the circumstances of this market, given the barriers to entry for cemeteries and given totally imperfect information possessed by many consumers who are thrown into the unforeseen and grievous circumstances of having to make purchases in the death care industry, they aren't able to price compare in the way that I might be able to over the weekend if I want to buy a new set of pots and pans. I can look on Amazon, I can look at Target, I can look at Walmart. These consumers have to make decisions within hours and under terrible circumstances. What's more, I think if you could just, for the sake of argument, take the example of Madison. Let's just assume for the sake of argument that there are six cemeteries in Madison. Now, without the anti-combination laws, what we are rationally speculating will occur is that combination firms, maybe one, maybe two of them, will acquire an interest in the six cemeteries and will acquire an interest in maybe 20 funeral homes. That leaves the independent funeral homes who now face the exact foreclosure or raising rivals cost phenomenon that we describe. And through that strategy, the combination firms could put significant pressure, especially through their marketing budgets, their advertising, they could put significant pressure on people to go through the combination funeral homes. The circumstances are right for that kind of behavior, just as the court described in Brown Shoe.
Right, but that seems meaning no disrespect at all, but that seems a little like Steve Martin's routine on how to be a millionaire, right? First, get $1 million. So your analysis works if you first get a monopoly on cemeteries. But the combination of a funeral home and cemetery does not give you any additional ability to develop a monopoly on cemeteries.
Well, it does because the market is inherently local. Your question relied on the premise that if I'm in Madison and I have to bury a loved one and I don't find prices I like, I can drive up to Sheboygan. And that's not going to occur, especially because they have to make these decisions within hours.
Right. So let's slow down the analysis a little bit. So we say I have a need to bury a loved one, and there are a number of cemeteries in the city, and one of them happens to be integrated, cemetery funeral home, and I go to a funeral home that's not integrated. And I say, here's what my need is, and the funeral home says, here are the cemeteries that you can choose from. Cemetery A is $100 more expensive than B, than C, than D. And that's because they've got their own funeral home, so they charge more when people come from me. Isn't that consumer simply going to say, okay, well then A's off the table. I'll go to one of the other five.
I think the problem becomes after the foreclosure strategy is implemented, and now the rivals are driven out of the market and have a hard time getting back into the market.
Right, yes, but that's the first get $1 million part.
Oh, okay.
Right. So you've got to figure out how it is that an integrated firm will enable that an integrated firm to get a monopoly.
So initially, I think what Your Honor's question is highlighting that initially under the foreclosure strategy, there appear to be enormous benefits for consumers who use combinations. But that's the first step of the strategy. The second step of the strategy is to eliminate the price discrimination stuff and just go straight to high prices for everyone.
Right, but the price discrimination part actually benefits the competition. If you, as an integrated cemetery funeral home, raise the prices on consumers who come through other funeral homes, that's just going to drive them to other cemeteries.
But what if the other cemeteries are owned by the same combination firm or the other one in town, the one of two,
right,
in the Madison hypothetical?
Right. So, and that's the part that is not addressed by your anti-combination statute. That does not preclude the monopoly on cemeteries. You're assuming something that simply does not exist. And you're justifying the rationale for the statute. The rationale for it is that it will prevent something that you're assuming exists for the operation of the statute to have any significance. So you're getting a little bit of the cart before the horse.
I think Your Honor's rationale could justify a constitutional challenge to Section 7 of the Clayton Act or other antitrust provisions. Those antitrust provisions don't operate merely to prohibit combinations that have already formed. They can prophylactically, if the circumstances are such that they fear monopolistic tendencies, just a possibility of monopoly, that's what Section 7 says, then they can ban all combinations in those circumstances.
Right.
Now, certainly there's going to be...
Or put another way, what it seems to me the colloquy that Justice Kelly is engaging in with you is perhaps unintentionally, but to me very clearly highlighting the purpose underlying the statute, at least as argued by the state, which is to prevent the situation from arising, which I think is the point that you were about to make. That, no, you're not saying that you have the hypothetical $1 million, to use the analogy proffered, or you do not have the market locked up in the particular scenario that the hypothetical scenario you've outlined. But the reason for that is because of the law that's on the books. I think that's that's the gravamen of your argument. You're nodding your head.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, what I would like to talk about, and we haven't gotten to it yet, the Court of Appeals performed the analysis of the statute using both the Ferdin test, rational basis, as it's called, with teeth, and the traditional rational basis. What, if anything, is the state asking us to do with Ferdin?
You're going to hear a lot more about Ferdin in the next case. The state submitted a brief, and we'll stand up for 10 minutes to discuss Ferdin. But suffice it to say for this case that we think even if you keep rational basis with bite, as it's called, in Ferdin, because of the important constitutional rights that at least one opinion thought were implicated by that case, it wouldn't say anything about whether that test should apply to run-of-the-mill economic regulations. And more to your Honor's question, I think one of the problems in Ferdin is that the court applied rational basis with bite without explaining why that standard was justified under the circumstances. Maybe this court will determine there are circumstances that justify it in that context. But an unreasoned conclusion of law is entitled to very little stare decisis weight. Now, that brings up an important part of Mr. Essenberg's presentation, which is the older Wisconsin cases. We think it's helpful to put them generally in two categories. The first category consists of the cases decided in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. A lot of these cases are frankly bad law. Many of them interpret the 14th Amendment. One of them, Kreutzberg, actually holds that employers have a due process right to fire employees who join a union. We know that's not good law anymore. The second category of cases consists of a few decisions from, say, the mid-1950s. And we actually think that these cases, although they have some loose language, and the other side concedes that, they are entirely consistent with the traditional rational basis test that this court has applied over 35 times in the last three decades.
Counsel, I want to interrupt you with regard to the traditional rational basis test. I hear your argument really asking us to overrule the framework set forth in the Jelke case, 1927. That case, by commentators on our court and this court itself, has chosen that as representative of one of the seminal cases, I forget, out of the 25 or 30, of this court. And I'm not inclined to overrule a seminal case of this court. The background, and I've spoken on this case years ago, the background, 1927, when Rosenberry wrote that opinion, was oleomargarine. Now, most of these people here today are not acquainted with the wars regarding oleomargarine and pink oleomargarine and can you sell and manufacture oleomargarine. But the Jelke case, written by Rosenberry, indicated that, okay, it is an equal protection case. It's under the Wisconsin Constitution, right? And in summary, that in some cases, a proper exercise of the police power results in advantage to a particular class of citizen, the equal protection. To the disadvantage of others, what courts will look to when they have that is that we will look behind even the declared intent of the legislature and relieve citizens against oppressive acts when the primary purpose is not the protection of the public health, safety, and morals. The argument, you know, it's hard for us to understand the argument. The argument was it was against the morals under the police power, because it threatened the family farm, the American way of life, to sell oleomargarine and the moral order. One of the state senators said this, "I decline to accept as a substitute for butter something matured under the chill of death, blended with vegetable oils, and flavored by chemical tricks." So it's hard to us to understand what was going on at that time.
I don't know. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Probably. I mean, they were demonizing it. And Rosenberry went through the record, and he concluded that, indeed, there was ample cases and evidence to demonstrate the nutritious, wholesome food. He said that There's certainly no question of morals regarding the issue, nor of fraud. And so it was declared unconstitutional. And of course, he has that beautiful part that says, from the standpoint of constitutional rights, the legislature has no more power to prohibit the manufacture and sale of oleomargarine in aid of the dairy industry, because that's what was going on, than it would have to prohibit the raising of sheep in aid of the beef cattle industry, or to prohibit the manufacture and sale of cement for, of course, a very powerful industry at that time in Wisconsin, the lumber industry. But you're asking us to throw out the framework of analysis in that seminal case that allows us to, when there's an equal protection issue, to look behind the declared intent of the legislature. And the declared intent was to save the morality of our American way of life, and that it was not a healthy food and did not stand on its own with any merit. So respond to that. That gives the context of the question.
I was just about to quote that line, which
I think is a wonderful line.
They had a way with words back then.
Yes.
Jelke, we cite three times in our brief, and every time we cite it, we describe it as correctly decided. We do not want this court to throw out Jelke. Jelke does stand for the correct proposition that the legislature can't ban an article of commerce that everyone stipulates, as they did then, that it was healthful, not at all dangerous, and not at all fraudulently marketed.
And not immoral.
Not immoral. So there are limits to the police power.
So what happens if there was a dispute over whether oleomargarine was wholesome? Is that something that the court could consider?
It could consider, and I think a particularly telling part of Jelke is the part of the opinion that goes on for pages discussing Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court precedent, which is, it's odd why they would include that if the doctrine wasn't understood to be the same, put that aside. They go through, in painstaking detail, describing the three precedents from the Supreme Court on the topic of oleomargarine. And they say, well, under certain circumstances, the Supreme Court said you can ban it, but not where there is no risk of deception, right? And so, those facts matter. If there is a risk of deception because they're coloring the oleomargarine to look like butter, then it's a different case. And those questions are important. So what we look to, as the Ninth Circuit put it in Merrifield, is whether it's economic protectionism for the sake of itself,
as an example of the cement. Yeah, but as far as the question, though, of whether it was wholesome or not, that's a factual question, right? Correct?
Yes.
Okay. And is it appropriate for the court to inquire into whether or not oleomargarine is actually unwholesome?
The court starts by assuming that the rational speculations that the state offers are true. That's an important distinction. That's not how it works under strict scrutiny or intermediate scrutiny.
Right. So starting at that, at first base there, the challenger has an opportunity to make a factual challenge to that foundation, correct?
Yes, if the challenger can show that the facts presumed to be true are not in fact true, then that's a much stronger rational basis challenge.
Okay.
That's right. And that's Jelke. But here's what Mr. Porter's asking for. Every regulation of the free market is in some sense protectionist. It is distributing resources that the market would allocate one way in a different way. Minimum wage laws, hours restrictions, business subsidies, tax financing for a special project. All of these take money from one part of the economy and move it to another part of the economy.
But now, this case has some important distinctions, which you touched upon lightly previously. Not so lightly. We're not talking about a decision whether to buy land. We're not talking about, I can't remember the thing, tires or something you said about checking on Amazon over the weekend. We're talking about, I haven't heard you mention the police powers of the state, which is the, as you know, the power of the state to regulate for the health, welfare, morals of the citizens. And the health and welfare of the citizens when a loved one dies and decisions need to be made. Now, I have friends in the funeral industry, and I can't tell you how often they have tell people or urge people to do pre-planning. I mean, as a favor to the survivors, to avoid this kind of emotional overload and to avoid the kind of vulnerability to some of the, well, the vulnerability that can be avoided. So we're not talking about, number one, we're not talking about a discretionary purchase. We're not talking about a purchase where the customer, the consumer, has the luxury of time to do a lot of comparison shopping. We're not talking about an industry where most people are educated consumers. Why haven't you talked about the police powers of the state in this particular instance? The other examples you've cited seem to be somewhat in opposite to what we're talking about here.
I was just about to go to police powers. The difference is, as Your Honor intimated, that the state doesn't have a police power to discriminate on the basis of race or something. They have, however, a police power to make determinations about what is best in the interest of the people. And that's exactly what they've done here. Your Honor explained why this market's different. I'll add also that a lot of consumers in this industry are one-time purchasers. Sometimes you only have to be put in these circumstances once in your life. You haven't done it before. Now, some people think you should pre-plan, but that's hard to do. People don't really want to face this possibility. So the market is not the perfectly rational market of the economics textbooks. People are forced into it quickly and under terrible circumstances and have to make decisions quickly. And so that does change the analysis. Now, returning to this economic freedom idea, Article 1, Section 1 says, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. There are all kinds of laws that are going to bear on economic freedom in some way, and this Court's actually considered several of them in the more than 36 cases we've looked at in the past 30 years. One is Blake. That was a law that told a daycare provider that she could no longer provide her services because of an old misdemeanor conviction. That person lost her only means of livelihood, at least for the past 7 years that she was practicing that vocation. Nevertheless, this Court didn't send it to a jury for a trial. This Court didn't comb through expert reports. This Court considered that the law under which Ms. Blake was not able to perform that function in the economy was based on good reason. I could cite a dozen other cases that also burden economic freedom in some way, in much ways worse than this law allegedly does, including, by the way, minimum wage laws.
Right. So there are the cases on that are legion, but mostly because there is an easy logical connection between the statute and the proffered justification. So here, however, it seems that the state is suggesting that the state gets a completely free hand in economic regulation because it's a complex field, right? But complexity doesn't relieve the state of having to show a rational basis for the connection between the statute and the objectives, right?
Right, but it's not complexity. It's the hallmarks of anti-competitive behavior plus the fact that it is a far from perfectly rational market.
Yeah, and let's assume that's true. Is it true, then, that the only thing the state needs to do is paste the label anti-competitive on the statute, and that will be sufficient to satisfy any judicial review?
Paste the label on the law? No, they don't have to do that.
Okay, or in your brief, no. Right? So it's not sufficient just to say, well, we think that this is going to have a positive effect on potential anti-competitive behavior. It's got to be more than that,
yeah.
Right?
I think what the state has to do is what we have tried to do in our briefing in this case. We didn't just say anti-competitive behavior. We explained it. We cite antitrust treatises. We cite case law. The case law, the secondary sources, make the logic clear, and other sources as well. Just like in the Northwest Airlines case, this court upheld a tax statute on the basis of a few secondary sources, including a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article. You don't need to go before the jury and have a battle of the experts in these cases. There's such thing as rational speculation.
Yeah. So you say the logic is clear in the connection between the anti-combination statute and the desire to eliminate anti-competitive behavior. Under rational basis review, can we challenge that logic?
I'm not sure what you mean by we. The plaintiff certainly has an opportunity to disprove the presumed facts.
Mm-hmm.
But
what I mean by that is, we're being asked to whether the statute has a rational basis for its existence. So can we look at the logical connection that the state has asserted between the statute and the objective, and determine for ourselves whether that logic holds up?
Yes. The question of whether there's a rational relationship between the legitimate interests, which everybody concedes exist here, and the ends that the state has proffered, is a question of law that this court determines on the basis of the briefing. And on the basis of that briefing here, we not only have antitrust law, by the way, we also have an extensive expert report prepared by a Stanford-educated economist. Now, he might have made mistakes, but I think he's explained, using the principles of his trade, why the legislature could have made this decision. The other side has an economist, too. I expect that in a minimum wage challenge or an hours law challenge or a business subsidy challenge, both sides could find economists to say, we think this law doesn't make good sense. But it can't be that any time you have an economist who says bad things about a law, you're now suddenly going before the jury on the question of the facial constitutionality of a duly enacted statute. I think Wisconsin court system, Wisconsin law would look a lot different if that became the law as a result of
this case.
Wouldn't
that be a big step from where we are now? I mean, I was surprised when opposing counsel said what they're arguing is the right to prove certain facts, because I can understand this case much better as a question of law, given what everybody has submitted. But if you're going to take it back before a jury, I don't understand how you ever will get finality of what the legislature does then. And you get it until somebody has enough energy and money to challenge it in court? Is that where we would go?
Yes, it's particularly odd in the circumstance of a facial challenge.
Right.
And it's not clear how much the facts would have to change in order for the facial constitutionality of the law to change as well. I mean, I don't even know how you would instruct a jury on the rational basis test.
Right.
I'm not sure what they would be finding. I assume they would be finding the ultimate mixed question in their view on whether the law furthers these purposes, but I think this is new territory, to be sure. There is the example of the Dairy Queen case, which I'll admit I had to read it a few times when I saw that the circuit court judge actually performed a taste test and found, as a matter of fact, that Dairy Queen was wholesome and tasty. Not sure that that's the way to
check. 1955, Senator Gordon Roselip doing an oleomargarine.
And the legislature has every right to do that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to tell Justice Bradley that I do remember oleo runs from the late 1960s down to the border to buy oleo margarine. The state concedes that you can't ban an article of commerce for no reason at all, and then goes on to say that everybody agrees that oleomargarine was a wholesome product. But they didn't agree that it was a wholesome product. It was, in fact, sharply disputed. But with respect to the record before the court in Jelke concluded that there was no evidence, there was no rational reason to conclude that it was an unwholesome product. The point is not the court, it's not for the court to decide whether it's wholesome. It is for the court to decide whether a rational person could come to the conclusion it is an unwholesome. And if an irrational person could not come to that conclusion, then the law does not stand.
Counselor, I want to be sure that Justice Abrahamson has had an opportunity to participate in past oral arguments. She's always asked a question. So just to interrupt a bit, Justice Abrahamson, do you have any question you want to ask? Because we are in rebuttal now, and I don't want to overlook your participation. Are you there? I'm sorry. Then please go ahead.
She might be on mute.
Please go ahead.
I'm sorry. I said
here she is.
Questions I had were asked by other justices, so I'm satisfied.
Okay, thank you very much.
I have a question for you.
She asked have been asked by others. So.
Right.
Okay.
So if this were to go back, we have competing expert affidavits, competing reports. You would have both experts testify before the trial court and the trial court to give more weight to one expert versus the other?
No, I would not put it that way because this is not a case of competing experts and we simply decide which one offers the better argument about the anti-combination
law. Is it given the presumption that works in favor of the state then?
Absolutely it works in favor of the state.
Because, so why isn't their expert enough?
Because let me explain why. First of all, I think the state was wrong when it characterized the plaintiff's expert in this case as not saying that the law cannot serve the posited end. He absolutely said that the law cannot serve the posited ends. He said that the circumstances in the death care industry are such that foreclosure cannot happen. He then went on to point out in the 39 states that permit combination laws, foreclosure has not happened. Funeral homes, standalone funeral homes, retain 80% of the market. In response to that, the state here offered an affidavit of an economist, and he's a quite qualified economist, and he talked about economic theory. And he said, although foreclosure is rare, there are circumstances in which it could happen, but the undisputed record in this case is that those circumstances are not present. Cemetery land is not scarce. It is not something that you can use to engage in a scheme of tying or predatory pricing. And so this law becomes simply a way
Counsel,
to protect
you can't just put
homes.
A cemetery anywhere.
Pardon?
Aren't there laws regulating where you can put a cemetery? You can't just say, well, I've got, 40 acres on my back 40 I'm not using. I'm going to turn it into a cemetery. You can't do that.
Well, there are laws regulating really where you can put anything. You
right.
Know,
so I think
with
you
them,
can't. You said that cemetery space is not scarce, and I would put it to you, it's not quite freely available either.
The undisputed record in this case, offered by Dr. Porter, Dr. Halbrook, Mr. Porter, Dr. Halbrook, and Dr. Harrington, and not refuted by anyone, is cemeteries can't sell the land that they have. So it is not the type of product over which you have economic power that you can engage in a scheme of predatory pricing. The hypothetical that the state offers about capturing all the cemeteries and capturing funeral homes is something that the anti-combination law doesn't address. The anti-combination law is not geared towards preventing monopolization. The antitrust laws are. So to use Justice Kelly's hypothetical, the problem here is if the problem is get $1 million, the anti-combination law does not prevent you from getting $1 million. What the anti-combination law winds up doing is protecting funeral homes from competition, from people who might provide a product that consumers want. And it is ironic, I think, to seek to justify the law invocation of the difficult time that families have when they face the loss of a loved one. Because what this law does is it forecloses competition.
Thank you, Counselor.
And that would be fine.
Thank you very much. Very good arguments and a very interesting case. The briefs were excellent, and they'll give us a lot to think about. We're going to take a brief recess now so some people can leave and others can come in for our second argument. We are prepared.